to Day On Against the Grain. What does the proliferation of nighttime labor say about the workings of capitalism? And what did Marx say about wage labor done at night? I'm C.S. Paul Apostolidis interprets Marx's writings and evaluates contemporary worker struggles coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We talk about the workday and about the 9-to-5 grind, but millions of people work at night. This expansion and intensification of labor during the wee hours, contends my guest today, has become a hallmark of work life under neoliberal capitalism. But nighttime work has long been a phenomenon and a concern. Karl Marx wrote about it in the mid-1800s, and his discussion of night labor in Capital has attracted the interest and scrutiny of Paul Apostolidis. Paul is a professor in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics and Political Science. His books include The Fight for Time, Migrant Day Laborers and the Politics of Precarity, and Breaks in the Chain, What Immigrant Workers Can Teach America About Democracy. Paul has a manuscript under review about the role that nighttime labor plays within capitalism, and also about how Marx reported on and evaluated low-wage night work done in 19th century England. When Paul Apostolidis and I connected recently, I asked him whether and how the chapter about the working day in Marx's Capital Volume 1 differs from other chapters in the book.
There are two major ways that it stands out. If you've ever read Marx's Capital Volume 1, you know that the book is chock full of economic theory on an often abstract level, even though he's talking about very concrete processes and very historical processes. He's trying to unfold an account of the laws of capital formation, of the creation of value, especially through wage labor, as most people know. The working day chapter is distinctive, though, and it's drawn a lot of curiosity and interest from many commentators and academic commentators from many different kinds of disciplines. The one thing that really stands out about it is full of empirical detail of a kind that Marx just doesn't provide in other chapters. And when I say empirical detail, I mean that he's got lines and lines of quotations from working people who are working through the night, late at night, early in the morning, and suffering the consequences. Also, quotations from news sources and from government reports and the records of legislative sessions where factory inspectors in 19th century Britain were talking about the excesses of the industrial system in forcing workers essentially to work very, very long hours beyond what most human bodies can tolerate. So that's one thing that really stands out. Some people in anthropology even refer to those aspects of the chapter as like ethnographic material. The other thing that's really interesting about the chapter is that it is home to some of Marx's most resonant and interesting literary images. People often think of Marx, if you haven't read a lot of Marx, you think, well, you know, he's this theorist of capital and capital's processes and dynamics. And yes, that's completely true. But he also took great care with his writing, and he's an interesting and quirky writer in a lot of ways. And so what you have in the Working Day chapter are these metaphors that pop up repeatedly, especially metaphors for monsters that he's using to lend color and vitality to his account of capital's predations on the working class. The primary, you know, metaphor that I talk about in this chapter that I'm writing is the metaphor of the vampire. And we can talk about that more at length if you want, but the werewolves are in there as well. And there are other, you know, just fascinating literary aspects of the chapter, like multiple references to classical literature. Marx was obviously well-educated, and he uses references to Homer, to Virgil, and other classical writers strategically in his texts.
And what's your sense of why Marx included the amount of empirical and journalistic and historical material that he did in this chapter?
That, too, is a very interesting question. And scholars differ on their takes about why it's there. Some Marxist theorists find it kind of irritating and think that this stuff is, you know, nice, but it's really just kind of a sideshow because he hasn't really gotten to the meat at this stage of Capital Volume 1, to the meat of his account of what really drives forward the historical dynamics of capitalism. For example, in Moshe Postone's wonderful work, Time, Labor, and Social Domination from the 90s, you know, that is fundamentally a story about technological developments that capitalists use in order to intensify labor processes and to extract ever more value and ever more profit for themselves out of the labor that workers are providing. The technical term that Marx uses for that is relative surplus value. So when we're talking about the working day chapter, Marx is talking about what some analysts consider to be a more crude and earlier stage of this historical process of capitalism's development, where what employers are doing basically is lengthening the working day, making workers just stay on the job for longer hours every time they go into work so that they can wrestle more labor out of them. And you can see how that sounds like not as fine-tuned or not as difficult a process, certainly not as technologically intensive a process as changing the labor process so that it becomes a more institutionalized way of generating surplus value.
Now, as far as the workers' testimony or information about, you know, actual worker experience that Marx includes in this chapter, is it focused on daytime labor, nighttime labor, a mix? Is there a focus on one or the other kind of labor?
It's a mix. And I realize, too, that I haven't fully answered the question that you asked before, so I want to get back to that. But, here's the thing. So a lot of commentary on this chapter exists in the realm of Marxological studies, if you will. And I found it really curious when I was reading accounts of the chapter that people don't seem to have zeroed in on nighttime specifically as a dominant theme in the chapter. And then the thing is that when you look at the chapter with an eye to where is Marx talking about the night, nocturnal activity, workers who are on the job or, you know, enduring the consequences of hard labor in factories through nights and into early morning hours, you start to see night all over the place. So yes, he's talking about workers who are working days too, but there's a particular kind of emphasis, a real urgency, I would say, with which Marx wants us to think about this work happening at night. And so what I'm arguing in the chapter is that it's not just that he's talking about a kind of labor that extends in quantitative terms, longer hours, and beyond daytime hours into nighttime hours, you know, after dark or even through the middle of the night. I think he's saying he's using night in two ways. He's using the theme of night to symbolize a larger transformation that is happening to the working class as a whole that has to do with the erosion of working class people's capacities and resources and relationships for what's called social reproduction. And we can talk about that idea more too. And he's talking about night work. In addition to that symbolic level, I think he's talking about night work as materially enacting that process of destruction.
Social reproduction. Yeah, define that term and talk about what social reproduction has to do with the nighttime, with the evening, with the time when, you know, your average sort of 9 to 5, or, you know, back then people worked a lot longer, but a daytime worker, the time after they would return home and before they would go to sleep, or during the time they would sleep.
Yeah, that's good. I think it's easiest to think about social reproduction if you think about some of the concrete physical kinds of incidents or problems that Marx talks about in the chapter. I'll get to those in a second, but first of all, I think one way to kind of approach the concept that's helpful is to remember that as most people, you know, encounter Marx as a theorist who is saying that there's something that is fundamentally exploitative about wage labor in production. So capital is exerting a kind of domination over people when people are in the process of producing things that we all need to live our lives in a material sense, whether that's shoes for our feet or computers to do our work on or cars to drive around, what have you, or food, that it's in the process of production where, you know, most people understand Marx to be saying that's where capital's dominating power is most centrally located. And yet, you know, especially in the literature that has grown a lot in recent years and has antecedents in the earlier 20th century, even back to the 19th century, really took off in the 60s and 70s in feminist Marxist critiques of capitalism and of Marx, authors raise the question, who's producing the workers who are producing all of those material things? You know, Marx thought of the reproduction of the workforce in terms of what commodities would workers need to have, would they need to be able to buy with the wages they earned in order to sustain their life, like at a basic level where they could show up to the factory line, to the assembly line every day, and not fall down on the job, you know, be able at a minimal level to keep executing whatever the industrial function was that they were given. But then, you know, social reproduction theorists ask the question, okay, so you buy, you know, that raw meat, but, you know, unless you're just a huge fan of steak tartare, somebody's got to cook the meat, and somebody's got to clean the house and care for the children and, you know, raise new workers from childhood to adulthood, endow them with capacities, give them at least a moderate kind of social environment of security and relationality so that people, you know, are at least somewhat well-adjusted to the world. That's social reproduction in the broad sense. And then what I really like about what a number of social reproduction theorists have done too is that they've tried to look at the term in a way where we're not just looking at it as what functionally serves the interests of capital in terms of preparing workers to do these jobs in the ways that I've just described, but also how can social reproduction, those kinds of activities also involve at least incipient kinds of new freedom that don't relate to work. And, you know, most obviously that can be thought of in terms of love relationships that people have with those who are their intimate partners, family members, children, older people that they have relationships with and maybe care for. But it doesn't have to be just care. It can also be all of the other things that people do to renew themselves, to refresh themselves mentally, emotionally, physically, aesthetically. So, I mean, I look at social reproduction in a deliberately broad sense, not a sort of strictly economic functionalist sense, because I think I'm attracted by arguments of others who say that, yeah, you know, this is where we can find the impulses toward a broader kind of human freedom that isn't just centered on the value of work and labor and production. So that's what I'm talking about in the book. And then I think that this is what's so interesting, is when you look closely at Marx's chapter on the working day, sure, on a very obvious level, he's talking about the hyper-exploitation of people's labor in the system of production. You know, as they're being paid wages to produce whatever it is they produce. He talks about bakers, he talks about milliners, for example. But it isn't just about exploitation. That's my key message. Like, the chapter is also about the destruction of the whole world of working class social reproduction that is going on both inside and outside the factory.
Paul Apostolidis joins me on Against the Grain. He is professor in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics and Political Science. We are talking about a chapter of a manuscript Paul is working on that examines the role that nighttime labor plays within contemporary capitalism, and also how Karl Marx reported on and evaluated the phenomenon of night work in 19th century England. And we keep referring to the working day chapter. That is a chapter in Marx's Capital, Volume 1. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, to make things even more explicit, what do you think Marx is gesturing toward in terms of the kinds of activities that would normally take place in the evening and that are thereby preempted by the fact that capitalists are intruding into workers' work days and nights to an ever larger degree, in his opinion?
Thanks for that question, C.S. That gets exactly to what the way that I'm trying to read the chapter that is a little bit unusual, you know, because it's saying, okay, workers are working at night, but what is being displaced that they otherwise might be doing at night? So, you know, I was struck, I have been struck by the extent to which Marx writes about workers who are trying to snatch small amounts of sleep in cramped, uncomfortable, dirty, noisy places in the factory. So he's talking on one level, obviously, about how they can't go home and sleep because they're working these long, long hours in the factories. And the hours have gotten excessive. There are just too many work hours, and it encroaches into the time when people should be at home sleeping. But it isn't just about the time. It's not just about the quantity of hours. It's also about the quality of one's day. It's about, he's talking about people that are trying to perform or conduct the kinds of activities that they normally would conduct at home in a kind of squeezed-in environment inside the production realm. So he talks about a baker who tries to stretch out on the hard board where he's been kneading his bread, and he makes a little pillow out of a sack and rolls another sack around himself to try and get a little bit more comfortable. A little boy who's sleeping on the floor of a furnace to try to keep warm with a bit of jacket over him. And then he talks about this young woman who he says had worked uninterruptedly for 26 and a half hours with 60 other girls, 30 girls in each room. And he says that at night, the girls slept in pairs in the, quote, stifling holes, I'm reading from Marx now, into which a bedroom was divided by wooden partitions. It's significant there. He's talking about the bedroom being displaced into the workplace. And so he's saying that work has so encroached on people's social reproductive lives that the home doesn't even exist anymore as a separate realm of activity. And if you think about the bedroom, too, and it's a really intimate kind of space to be talking about. The girls are sleeping in pairs with each other. They're not sleeping with their kids or their partners or, you know, whoever. It's this strange doubling of worker to worker that also, I think, reflects the way that he's doubling the identity of the workplace with the identity of the home. They're becoming one and the same place. So that, I think, is a reference. It's a very spatial kind of reference to the way that social reproduction is being eclipsed and kind of taken over in total by the scheme of production.
And so you're right, Paul, that the target is not only the tormented body of the individual worker, it is also the social, relational, living tissue of working class reproduction. What's your sense of, because I know this is your reading of Marx, what is your sense of the degree to which Marx was trying with this chapter to, as you write, document capital's insatiable desire to consume more and more of the workers' vital energy and daily time? So that's sort of the, you know, maybe a more common interpretation of this chapter in Capital, and or investigating or pointing toward the cost in terms of social reproduction, the cost that it extracts from workers. Is it both? Is it either? Are you trying to foreground the social reproductive aspects of what he's saying more than perhaps he is?
That's an interesting and tricky question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult to tell what his intentions were. But I think that I can sense him feeling in the text feeling his way towards a broader account of what's going on at nighttime when people are forced to work through the night in order to survive, that goes beyond the kind of squeezing of ever more value or surplus value, if you will, from their wage labor. I think that really was his primary concern, if you're looking at his politics and the overall analysis of capital that you get in, you know, especially if you look at also the unpublished material in previously in his lifetime in Capital's Volume 2 and 3. But at the same time, there is so much in there that refers to the social reproductive environments in which workers gain some kind of security and some sense of physical wellness and stability, or could if they weren't being prevented from that by the economic system, that it's clear that these issues are crucial for him, and he's trying to get us to pay attention to them. And I just think that looking at the way that nighttime does that, that night keeps coming up as a theme in the chapter, is the best way to clue into that aspect of Marx's argument. But I think, you know, I think what I'm trying to say is that there's a basis in the text for ideas about social reproduction that Marx himself sensed but didn't fully think through, and others since then have thought through more carefully. And so I think the text can be used as a way to validate the directions in which, these directions in which Marxist thought, especially Marxist feminism, about social reproduction has gone in recent years. That's not just a matter of analyzing how does capitalism work and in what ways is it oppressive to people and how is it gendered. Those are vital questions, but I think there's also a political question that comes out of that, which is nothing less than how do you define working class struggle and what the objectives of struggle should be and what the targets of struggle should be. So, you know, people have been arguing for quite some time, especially given lots of tendencies in the new economy and, you know, the breakdown of industrial employment in the global north, you know, as jobs have been shipped overseas and outsourced. People have been arguing that to focus on the workplace or to fetishize the workplace as the main place where working class organizing and working class politics must take root, that is not going to work because the workplaces have become too dispersed. I wrote about this a lot in my last book, which is about migrant day laborers in the United States who get scattered all over urban areas to do work on which the construction industries in major U.S. cities depends in a fundamental way, especially residential construction. But there's no factory where you can organize day laborers. They work on their own. Similarly, there's no factory where you can organize people who increasingly get jobs doing child care or elder care or domestic work of other kinds on online platforms. So you have to sort of think of other sites in society where people could be politicized. And the broad realm of social reproduction, I think, offers the promising way to think about those kinds of politicization and those sites of politicization that do continue to hold promise as we go forward.
The book my guest Paul Apostolidis was referring to was his book, The Fight for Time, Migrant Day Laborers and the Politics of Precarity. You also bring up the issue of temporality, and you reflect on, in this chapter of the manuscript you're working on, you reflect on the way in which time is experienced by workers, and specifically how that experience is changed by nighttime work. Tell us about that.
Well, the main way that I want to talk about time and temporality and night work in this chapter is through a kind of writing tactic and analytical tactic that I will acknowledge has been, I feel a bit impish about it, but it really has to do with thinking about the vampire and the way that the vampire metaphor works in Marx's argument, not just as a kind of a nice grace note to an idea that he's trying to express, but really trying to convey important theoretical points that are central to his argument. So people see the presence of the vampire in Marx's text. There's a quotation that I'd like to read you. So briefly, toward the beginning of the Working Day chapter, Marx writes, "Capital has one sole driving force, the drive to valorize itself, to create surplus value, to make its constant part, the means of production, absorb the greatest possible amount of surplus labor. Capital is dead labor, which, vampire-like, lives only by sucking living labor. It lives the more labor it sucks. So the most obvious significance of that quotation there is, you know, you think of the vampire, well, that must be a figure for the capitalist, right, who's trying to suck all of the work that he possibly can from out of these poor workers. And this is the direction in which most of the literary commentary about the vampire metaphor in Marx, and there's a lot of it, it's the direction in which most people go. And it's perfectly valid. I mean, Marx is talking there quite obviously about exploitation and hyper-exploitation. And there's a sense that the vampire, you know, if you ever watched Buffy or any of the movies or read any of the books about vampires, you know, vampires are insatiable in their thirst for blood. And so this is the main theme that people formulate and use to interpret this passage in Marx. I think the vampire is really interesting too, though, because the vampire is a creature of the night. And you just don't see that in the commentary thus far. So, and then I think when you think about the vampire as a creature of the night, you start to get a window on what the metaphor suggests that Marx's text is saying about experiences of time and time's passage between day and night in this chapter. I think that there are three key aspects of temporal experience that come to light when we look at the vampire metaphor in that way. First of all, and this is not my original observation, but it comes in just one article that I found so far, and I think it's really right on the mark. The vampire is a night worker. So he's not just a capitalist who is exploiting the workers. As a nighttime laborer, the vampire is a lot like the workers, because the vampire can only work at night. You know, by day, they have to hide from the light so they can't go roam around and, you know, try to bite people on the neck. So in that sense, the vampire represents the need to labor through the night and also represents the kind of way that capitalism doesn't just, you know, it is a matter, on the one hand, of relational domination, as Albina Osmanova calls it, where, you know, one class is oppressing another and exploiting another. But it's also a matter of what she calls systemic domination, which means that everybody is rendered unfree in a fundamental sense under capitalism, even though obviously the Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos of the world have it a lot better than most people. And people who have affluent occupations, you know, also have it well. So there's that aspect of the metaphor that's important to note. There's also this aspect that has to do with the vampire's perpetual vigilance over the passage of time. Because the vampire is going to get destroyed if he gets exposed to sunlight, he's always got to be careful. He's always got to be watching for, like, how long will the night last? When is time running out? Does he have enough time to feed and get the kind of nourishment that he needs? That anxiety, that constant watchfulness about time's passage, that's another temporal characteristic that I think the metaphor suggests. You see that a lot in today's economy with the growth of what we call precarity in so many occupations, where more and more of the day is, on the one hand, chopped up into different kinds of wage earning activities, but at the same time, there's a contradictory experience of time where people have this constant anxiety that's quite understandable about, are they going to actually end up earning enough through these various low-paying jobs to be able to make ends meet.
That's the voice of Paul Apostolidis. He is professor in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics and Political Science. We have a spelling of his last name on our website, againstthegrain.org. His books include Breaks in the Chain, What Immigrant Workers Can Teach America About Democracy, and Stations of the Cross, Adorno and Christian Right Radio. And we are talking about a chapter of a manuscript about nighttime work that Paul is developing and that is being reviewed by a publisher as we speak. This chapter examines the role that nighttime labor plays within the workings of contemporary capitalism and also looks at and analyzes Karl Marx's chapter about the working day that can be found in Marx's book, Capital, Volume 1. And I think I cut you off there, Paul. You had a third point to make about the vampire.
Yes, it's a very fruitful metaphor. The third point to make about it is that I think that the vampire puts front and center the issue of social reproduction, which, as I've been saying, is my main theme in my particular angle on this important chapter from Marx's Capital, Volume 1. Vampires gesture towards social reproduction because, first of all, if you think about it, vampires don't just feed off of human beings. They bring new vampires into being with each bite that they make at night. So they're always reproducing. So that's kind of like reproduction to excess. They can never get enough blood, so they're constantly converting existing human beings into more and more vampires. So there's like reproduction happening all over the place. At the same time, the vampire story is about the futility of reproduction, the inability to ever get enough, to ever be satisfied. And so in that sense, it also represents the ways that capital deprives workers of that kind of fullness for the sake of reproducing itself, of reproducing economic value. But overall, you know, when you initially asked about, when I started talking about the vampire initially, this was in response to your question about time and the way that the chapter deals with the theme of time. And what I think that it's most important to say about that is the way that for Marx in this chapter, the problem is not just that workers don't have enough time to do things like properly feed themselves, get enough sleep, take care of their children, have a modicum of physical rest, renewal, exercise, what have you. It's not just that the quantity of time is too little, it's also the quality of time has become all the same. So that time is homogenized. All time is given over to capital's reproduction. So the consequence then is that people lose a sense of how one moment of the day differs from any other. It's all just kind of an endless repetition of the same. I think that's what the vampire story suggests as well.
So Karl Marx in this working day chapter, he brings up the political and legal struggles, right? The struggles within bodies like Parliament to limit the length of the working day. And yeah, a lot of working class energies were devoted to these political legal struggles. What stance does Marx take on these struggles? Does he think they are necessary? Does he think they are appropriate? Does he think they are the main way forward?
Well, as I read Marx, I think he's actually a little bit torn. Although for listeners who've read Marx before, probably not surprised to hear that the main thrust of his discussion of the parliamentary battles over imposing legal limits on the working day in England, roughly between the 1830s and the 1860s, and especially concerning a set of bills in Parliament called the Factory Acts. Listeners who are, you know, familiar with Marx to some degree will probably not be shocked to hear that on the whole he expresses a lot of skepticism, even dripping sarcasm at times, regarding the utility of workers and working class organizations investing all that much effort in these kinds of bourgeois legislative battles. I mean, his account of the struggles over the Factory Acts, or as he calls it in the last three sections of the chapter, the struggle for a normal working day, he tends to emphasize the ways that no matter how hard lawmakers tried and humanitarian reformers tried to set reasonable limits on the working day, bring it down to, let's say, 10 hours a day, factory owners and managers found all kinds of nefarious and devious ways to get around those limits. So, for example, when they established the shift system, which didn't really exist until this era in English history, there was a legal measure passed at one point, Marx writes, that workers were not allowed, they were not to be allowed to work two shifts in a row. You know, they could only work one shift. Well, what Marx says factory owners decided to do was to just move workers around to a different station within the factory. So they weren't doing the same job for two shifts in a row. And that way they did an end around the legal rule that had been imposed. And if you read these sections of the chapter, Marx is just describing how time after time these kinds of things happen. Or if, let's say, there's a way in which under one of the provisions of the Factory Act, it's found that a factory owner has violated some kind of legal provision, you get to the court and it's stacked with people who are friendly to, or even are themselves, the factory owners. So the overall tone and message of those final parts of the chapter, where he's talking more about the politics of trying to limit work hours and limit the working day, is really quite pessimistic. That said, you know, a lot of what I'm doing in this chapter is very close reading of this text in this kind of, you know, geeky, in the weeds academic way. But I think it's worth it here, because if you pay very close attention, you see a couple of things that stand out. So one is a meaningful silence, or a couple of meaningful silences in the text. So at one point, Marx is talking about how a bunch of workers signed what's called the Dunkirk Resolution, demanding that they have better treatment in terms of work hours. And on the one hand, this kind of reinforces the negative or pessimistic line of thought as Marx is talking about these kinds of parliamentary battles, because he doesn't really say if the resolution produced anything, and you know, he's not even really presenting workers as particularly powerful political agents. He doesn't quote them as, you know, making heroic stands or engaging in you know, successful acts of organizing. He doesn't really quote workers much at all, except as a kind of formless group of people who sign a petition. That's in contrast to the way that that part of the chapter is all the time quoting elites, you know, whether they're well-meaning humanitarian reformers who are morally offended by the, you know, and sort of clucking their tongues at the ways that their fellow elites are treating poor workers, or factory managers themselves. Workers are just kind of like nameless. They're not individuals. They're kind of a sideshow. And yet, Marx himself wrote the Dunkirk Resolution. And it turns out he actually was active in political efforts to try to limit the working day by law. So what's going on there? Like, why is he not bringing that to the fore? Why is that there in just sort of like a subtle way that he's suggesting? I read that as a kind of ambivalence on his part. You know, he doesn't want working class organizations to take their eye off the ball, or to sort of divert their focus from the long-term goal, which is nothing short of communist revolution. It is a radical transformation of society as a whole, especially through transformation of ownership and control of the means of production, socializing the means of production and reinventing them in the interest of human freedom. That said, though, Marx is also trying to draw attention, I think, to the need to engage on many fronts in the build-up to that kind of revolution. And I think he is also saying, or implying, that workers' organizations shouldn't completely discount the kinds of gains that you can make by having one of those fronts be the, yes, admittedly bourgeois-dominated, but still real and sometimes practically valuable realm of parliamentary politics. The other aspect of the chapter that I think speaks to this interpretation is more about an excess of words than a silence, or a lack of words, like a lack of commentary on the fact that he wrote the Dunkirk Resolution that he's quoting there.
An excess of words. So, Paul, what does Marx say that he perhaps doesn't need to say, or to spend so much time on, or to give so much detail about?
You know, for someone who is saying that the parliamentary process is, you know, just a futile thing for workers' organizations to participate in, or to believe that they could make any meaningful change through, Marx says an awful lot about the processes, the precise details of how the wrangling happened in various committees and parliamentary endeavors to get these acts passed, and then how factory owners responded, and then how the government then tried to come back and change things yet again. And I think that all of this detail, it does two things. On the one hand, it does build a case that no matter how hard reformers tried, capital kept on finding ways to circumvent the legal limits that had been invented. It does something else, though. Like, I think it sort of manifests, it performs, if you look at the text as, you know, not just saying something, but performing or enacting something, doing something. It performs a kind of fascination with the political realm in a conventional sense of policymaking and battles over legislation. And I wouldn't want to discount that as part of what's going on in the text. And I say that I think that there's an ambivalence there because Marx doesn't say that outright, but I think it's reasonable to read the text as at least equivocating a little bit, there being a subtle message about the need for very diverse tactics rather than just, you know, you can't, you know, waste your time with bourgeois political wrangling over these issues. You just got to focus on organizing the proletariat for revolution. The text doesn't fully support that. And I think Marx was obviously far smarter than to think that it was easy to put together the proletariat as a political force. And so that's how I read that latter part of the chapter.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Paul Apostolidis joins me. He is professor in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics and Political Science. So if you agree, and I know you do, that reform ain't enough, right? That merely trying in the halls of power to limit the length of the working day is not enough for true worker emancipation, for true emancipation of people in society, then given your focus on social reproduction again, which means sort of those activities and things that are required to sustain workers so that they can go to work the next day, the feeding and the cooking and the cleaning and the sleeping and the nurturing that is needed in order for workers to reproduce themselves in a sense each day. And of course, social reproduction also includes the making, the literal baby making, the making of new workers to serve the needs of capital in the future. Given your focus on social reproduction, what then do you think is the proper struggle to wage? And what struggle might Marx agree with you is the proper struggle to wage if the concern is not just, the worker and the way they are treated during the production day or night, but something larger, something that extends into the social reproductive realm?
Yeah, it's both an impossible and an irresistible question. What would Marx think, you know, if he read this, or if he were around today and were confronting the very altered circumstances in capitalism and in society more generally that exists? So I think that the way that I make sense of the ambivalence that I talked about over the validity and utility of participating in ordinary political processes to try to make change happen for workers is that if you go back to the critique of night work as imperiling social reproduction, not just hyper-exploiting workers in the scene of production, but destroying the resources, the relationships, and the capacities of working class people as a whole, this then offers some momentum for redefining what the political struggle should be about. The problem is if you engage that struggle in a way that just plays a numbers game, that tries to sort out, bicker about, bargain over just how many hours quantitatively each day the capitalist should be free to exploit the worker at will. You know, should that be 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours? And this would apply also to contemporary movements to try to limit the working day further. I mean, there's some very energetic, and I think in many ways very worthwhile movements. One right here in England that is being spearheaded by a great organization called Autonomy UK to institutionalize 4-day work weeks without any reduction in pay or 30-hour work weeks. These are great ideas, but I think Marx is saying that the real battle for freedom should take up the fight for free time, both within and beyond the turf of parliamentary maneuvers. And the key is to highlight not just the quantity of hours that workers need to really have, you know, some life apart from work, but also highlight what is qualitatively at stake in combating the process that I talked about before, where it's not just that there isn't enough time for workers to be themselves, to take care of themselves and others. It's also the homogenization of time as a whole, the assimilation of all temporal experiences to the logics of capital. And we can talk about the ways that that manifests in certain occupations today, like the world of microwork that I also address in this chapter. But I think the idea is that as long as contestants in the battle for justice for workers remain stuck on just the number of waged hours that the capitalists control, rather than demanding, let's say, a new freedom for workers to do what they desire with their wage time, their unwaged but still working time, and their non-working time, if people keep being stuck on the number of hours, then we won't yet have joined the fight for the bigger kind of freedom that Marx wants people to believe is possible and to really to aspire to achieve.
What does Marx say in this chapter in, again, Capital Volume 1 about child workers forced to work at night?
I'm glad you asked about that aspect of the chapter, C.S., because it's a very prominent and I think a very important feature of the chapter. So Marx isn't just talking about workers in general who have to work these insanely long hours and don't have time to get home to sleep or to feed themselves properly or any number of other kinds of self-care activities or care for others. The workers, not all, but a great number of the workers whom he quotes and discusses are children. And that's significant in a couple of ways. So on the one hand, he's driving home the message of just how hurtful excessive work hours and work hours through the night in particular are for human bodies. And he's looking at these particularly vulnerable human bodies, the bodies of children, to make that point, you know, as strong and as really as dark as possible. And of course, you know, when we're talking about children who are working through the night, you know, you think about, oh my God, children of all human beings, children should be in bed in the nighttime. And so he writes in a typical passage, for example, children of 9 or 10 years are dragged from their squalid beds at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning and compelled to work for a bare subsistence until 10, 11, or 12 at night, their limbs wearing away, their frames dwindling, their faces whitening, and their humanity absolutely sinking into a stone-like torpor utterly horrible to contemplate. You know, he spares little there to try to get a sense across of just how devastating this is for young human beings. I think that the theme of time is also very important here, though. It's not just, again, it's not just the quantitative time of there being too much time at work and not enough time for sleep, especially for the young. It's also, I would say that the passage evokes two different senses of embodied time or bodily time. On the one hand, you have this temporality of immediate bodily experience because overwork is exhausting and even killing the body of the vulnerable human, the young human, each day that extends into the nighttime hours. But I think by focusing on children and children as a group, not just individual children, although there are plenty of quotations from just individual workers that are just appalling to read. But when he's talking about children, he's also talking about, he's evoking a more extended historical time frame in which the working class as a whole over the long term is becoming more and more unwell, more and more incapacitated. And then he even quotes physicians from London who make reference to what he calls a degenerated population that they see as emerging among pottery workers, with each successive generation being more sickly and stunted than the preceding one. The doctors say that the workers thus are becoming, quote, prematurely old and certainly short-lived. And so I think what Marx is doing there is inviting us to reflect on what happens to the future of humanity, certainly of the working class as a whole. But he's saying that collectively our future is being imperiled as night work advances, and as the socioeconomic system has made nocturnal labor so prevalent. And you see that particularly graphically in the immediate, you know, fates of the children and the faculty, and then you see it if you cast your gaze into the future and look at the temporal horizon that awaits. So there are key aspects of the chapter that deal with the spatial aspects of night work's encroachment into social reproductive time and experience. And then there are the aspects that have to do not just with space, but also with time itself. And the fact that it's children we're talking about makes that particularly gravely compelling.
Paul Apostolidis, Apostolidis, professor of government at the London School of Economics. We've been talking about part of a manuscript he has in development that's under review, actually, by a publisher examining the nature of nighttime labor and the role that night work plays in contemporary capitalism. Thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thanks, C.S. It's been a real pleasure to be on this show. I appreciate your interest and listeners' interest in these issues. Urge people to explore them further. And also just want to say congratulations on an amazing 20 years that the show's been going. And here's to 20 years more.
Really appreciate that, Paul. And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.